Blog Talk Radio. That's my friend Chuck. He's going to echo everything I say today. Up to a point.
Dave, this is supposed to be a professional show.
Who ever told you that, Jay? When did you ever get that idea? All right. Okay, thank you. I'll just, now it's time for you to go to
That's a little bit of technology,
That's Chuck. Talking Chuck, I won't say why he's so notorious, but he's an iPhone app.
He's an iPhone app.
That everybody thought for sure would get banned. Overnight, and yeah, he's been banned. Luckily, I downloaded him. And parents don't like him. I'm not going to say why, but they don't.
Oh, yeah.
Very close-minded of them. I don't happen to be a parent myself, so I have a more liberal attitude towards these things.
We have a...
What's it? We have a technical problem here?
Yeah, I'm not hearing myself in my
Well, we hear you perfectly well.
Okay.
Can you trust us on that one? I mean,
yeah, I don't like it, but I'll trust you.
Well, maybe Adrian can do something. No, we can't stop.
No, we don't.
The
show must go on. We have a lot of things to talk about today.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, for example?
Well.
How professional we are?
Absolutely.
Not. I'm not a professional. I'm an amateur.
You're a professional amateur.
No. Well, you know, in order to be a professional, Jay, somebody's got to pay you.
Oh.
And I'm at a loss for words. Doesn't happen often, but
PressThink has a new design.
It does. It does.
I didn't actually tell you about that. I kind of surprised you with it.
I know. It was very nice. I liked the way you do paragraph level permalinks. I thought that was very innovative.
And one feature of the design is links for paragraphs, which I wanted in there because I saw that you had them at Scripting News. I always envied that. And I actually use them.
Mm-hmm.
And I use them by referencing a particular argument, let's say in another post or on Twitter, by linking to the specific place in a post where I make that argument.
Sure.
And it helps a lot, especially in combination with subheads, which can sort of tell you what that section is about. So that was built in. But a lot of other things were built in, too, because I was able to look at what I actually do with my blog and how I use it and build the things that I've learned about blogging into this new design.
So what are some other ideas that are in there?
Well, a simple example is I'm constantly having to give my bio to people for appearances.
Right, right.
So I just put it in there as the HTML itself. You can download it from the blog.
Right. Yeah, I've done that as well.
And
keep it current. Every year I change my age. Yeah.
Right. I can alter it myself and keep it current. And, you know, blogs are not very good at displaying on the surface the work that has come before that's archived, even though the archives themselves are easy to display. So I brought all those to the front through my highlight section, which I had on my other blog, but that's part of how I blog, is that the previous essays are there to be consulted at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have a whole section with myself on video, around all these YouTube clips and other lectures and appearances on television that I have accumulated. I took the best of those and put them into a tab on WordPress, which I didn't have before. I didn't have any tabs before. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a blog now. It's sort of a home for my work. And
that's what a blog should be.
Should be,
really.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
And the paragraph-level permalinks thing seems like that ought to be a feature of the web. It's just rational, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it also... makes it possible for you to do things with your blog that you couldn't otherwise do. Like,
yes.
For example, you know, I look at every blog post as being sort of a work in progress, sort of a notebook of a particular thing that I'm doing, right? And so if something new comes to light and I learn that something that I had in the blog post earlier was wrong, and I'll post an update at the bottom, and that should get equal distribution to...
Right.
To the blog post itself, And so you want to be able to point to that specific thing.
Exactly.
And the ability to be able to do that makes it possible to actually communicate that change. I mean, it's the difference between the, you know, the old story about how the mistake appeared on page one, but the correction appeared on page 27.
And never catches up to the mistake.
No, it never does. So the thing is that this gives you a better chance of actually having the correction make it up there.
Yes.
How are you doing on your headphone? Can you actually hear now? Or
No. So I can't hear my input into my
headphones. We're
losing
a lot here because Adrian's like really fussing with things, and that's killing our attention.
We can handle
it. So it's probably better just to leave it alone, Adrian, and just let us, you know, just sort of muddle along as best as we can without the distractions. So.
Yeah.
You know, they do that in baseball. The team, if they wanted, sometimes they don't run the base runners because they don't want to distract the hitter. I learned that watching the playoffs this week.
Yeah.
Very good baseball.
Yeah.
We're about to go into the World Series with two teams that very rarely make the World Series. One of them, in fact, has never actually made it at all. So
right.
The Texas Rangers. So
I'll be rooting against them for the obvious reason.
Why?
Bush used to be the president.
Oh.
of that team.
Oh, that's such an interesting. You know, I forget some of the ideas that I want to discuss on this. I forget, and this reminds me of I read in New York Magazine today. I haven't actually had a chance to read the article yet, but I bookmarked it, so I would. That there's actually a scenario under which Sarah Palin does become president in 2012, See, that would make us look back on the Bush days with fond memories.
Then we'd have to change the show to Rebooting the Country.
Oh, we'd have to change it to How Do I...
Rebooting the World.
It would be even worse than that. I think, you know, it all comes down to, you know, the disappointment with Obama. You know, Frank Rich had a great editorial piece in the Times yesterday. He talked about, you know, change you can believe in. Well, nobody believes in change you can believe in anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And, the reason we don't believe in that, of course, he said that basically it's a confusing race between one political party that's owned by business and another one that panders to business. You know, so if your pick, which one is which? And let me the question is maybe this society is so complicated that it just cannot be governed. That there's nothing we can do. It's just going to get worse and worse and worse. And maybe Sarah Palin's exactly the president that we should have in 2012. You know? That's a scary thought, huh?
Very.
I mean, we're so much smarter than Sarah Palin, but, you know, the thought, you know how complicated New York is, right? I mean, New York.
Yeah.
I mean, living in Manhattan has been a real eye-opener that way. I mean, New York is a complicated place.
Well, this is an important issue in understanding modern society is, levels of complexity and when a system gets so complex that it becomes ungovernable.
Well, New York may not be governable, but it does run. You
it
know?
Runs, but it's also a hair trigger system.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely.
One bridge out, one tunnel in your...
And, of course, Sarah Palin would be president of New York, too.
I don't want to even think about that.
How would that work exactly, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Anyway.
We'd have to hunker down. Let's move on.
Let's move on.
We have this very exciting opportunity coming up on Saturday of this week in Washington, where you and I are going to do our show live before the Online News Association, which is all the professionals in the news industry who
are... Well, let's not oversell it. The room might be empty for all we know, right?
I doubt it.
Okay.
I'm just talking about the association itself. These are the professionals in the news industry who deal with the online world. And a lot of them are actually very progressive people who pay attention to the work that you know, innovators are doing, who want to reboot the news. And what we're going to try and do is outline for the group some of the master narratives that have guided the show.
Right. I think that's great. I think that's what we ought to do. We talked about this last time.
That's the way to go.
As to whether or not, I mean, you know, the question, though, is like, we are going to be upsetting some people, you know, when we do this.
Well, I don't think we should anticipate that.
No,
we should accept it if it happens.
I think, very good point. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely right. Keep your, you know, keep the space open. Maybe everybody, it'll just be a love fest. Although I watched Jeff Jarvis get ground into the ground on Twitter this weekend, arguing with a guy. I think he's from NYU, actually.
Yeah, Adam Pendergast. But that's just one argument from one person.
I know, but I had a little back channel with Jeff after that. I said, Jeff, why don't you like have a session at ONA where you like the topic is why I don't do interviews by Jeff Jarvis.
But he does do interviews.
It's true, he does. As a matter of fact, that's the nice thing about Jeff Jarvis is that he will take the extreme position even when it's not.
He'll argue with anybody, but that's admirable, you have to admit. Yeah, well, so what we're going to do is between now and then, we're going to put together some of those master narratives in a list, right?
Right. Dave? Oh, well, absolutely. In fact, I've started a blog post for exactly that purpose. And if you go there, and this is for people who are listening live right now. I just posted a tweet before the show started suggesting that people might want to listen live. And I've started a blog post at scripting.com, scripting.com. And the title of the blog post is Master Narratives of Rebooting the News, right, as you've said. And I have a link there to listening to the show live. So if you want to listen to the show, well, wait, if they're listening to this, they're listening. Never mind. Skip that one. So people listening to the show live, if you have want to add, if I mean, our memories are so bad, I guess that's the point. That we don't even remember what our master now
I do. I haven't put my mind to putting them down.
All right. Well,
I will.
Okay. So start reading some of them off, and I'll just write
them
down.
Okay. So we're already using the rebooted system of news.
Okay.
Would
hold
be
on.
One example.
Okay. We're already using the rebooted system of news. That's the easy one.
Right.
Right.
Every node in the system is a participant in the system. Every node in the network.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. We may go back and restate these
course,
things.
Of course, yeah. The sources go direct.
Well, you can't forget that, right?
Yeah.
I just did something terrible.
Put that in there.
I deleted everything. That is terrible. Hold on. I never have done anything like that. Sources go direct. I'm not even supposed to say that I did something awful. But
no. Narrating your typing online.
Well, no, because I need you to give me the second one again because I lost it. All participants are...
Every
all
node in the network is a participant in news gathering. It'd be another way of saying it.
I'm not going to go with that. And a participant in the system.
That's
what you said, and I like that, actually.
Yeah. Sources go direct.
Yeah, I got that one.
There's more. We'll think of them as we roll along.
Yeah, yeah, that's the idea. There are like 20 of them.
Yeah.
And we've only got three.
There's all the context, future of context points that I made repeatedly in the show.
Oh, I know. Okay.
We need the background as well as the stream of updates.
I don't know what that means.
Yes, you do. It's all right. I'll restate it later.
Right. But then there was the other one, the voice from nowhere.
Yeah, the view, view from nowhere.
Okay, so what's the statement?
The statement is...
There is no such thing as the voice from nowhere, as the view from nowhere.
No, the statement is...
every point of view...
It's easier to trust where I'm coming from than the view from nowhere.
Okay. It's easier to trust.
Here's where I'm coming from than the view from nowhere.
By the way, that's right.
But there probably are 10 to 15.
Well, you know, one way to hit them all, or at least the highlights, is to read those speeches from the people in the news industry.
Uh-huh.
That really presses some of the buttons, at least. And I found, you know, I'm reading the articles for this week's class now,
uh-huh.
and I'm finding that some of the people that are... there are a lot of myths that people buy into on both sides. And I hear a lot of things stated as, of course that's true, that I really think need to be challenged, need to be questioned. Like...
Mm-hmm.
You know, this whole idea that that real reporting is expensive.
Uh-huh.
This came up in one of the pieces that I wrote. The piece that I wrote for the last class is that, you know, if you actually listen to the words that these people are saying, the executives at the news organizations, you boil it down to what they're doing is they're paying people to witness events. That's what they say they're doing. I don't think that's actually what they're doing. I think they're paying people to both witness and to talk to other witnesses. Mm-hmm. And
right.
And
efficiency is creativity. That's another one.
But we have witnesses everywhere. And
right.
The question is, and some of them are capable of writing, and many of them are capable of the same level of objectivity that the reporters are, which is to say, none.
Right. Well,
I don't know how you capsulize that down into
maybe
a
we
mass
can.
Narrative. Yeah.
But last week in my class, we read 8 speeches from news executives trying to grapple with the future of news. This week, it's 10 blog posts and essays by bloggers and critics and sort of observers of the new on the same subject. And Dave is going to join us for that as well. So it'll be interesting to hear your reflections upon it afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Efficiency is creativity should be on your list.
I don't know what that means.
I'll explain it to you. But it means it's a reference to what you just said, that finding ways to do things that aren't expensive is what we can now do with the rebooted system of the news, and we should, because that allows more people to participate. And instead of seeing being efficient as some sort of problem or plague, which is how a traditional news person sees it, being able to do more at lower cost is a good thing.
It's a necessary
thing.
Yeah, you can't get there, can't get to the future without doing that.
Exactly.
Or you can't even exist in today. I mean, they're doing that by cutting out things that, you know, that maybe they should be cutting out later as opposed to right now.
Well, maybe 2,000 reporters all reporting on the same event in the Chilean desert isn't exactly an efficient use of...
Did we talk about that?
We did.
Because I know that made a huge impression on you.
Yeah, it's absurd.
It made no impression on me because I didn't consume any of that news.
Right.
Yeah. That was another...
Checkbox news. There's another one.
Checkbox news. That actually is becoming kind of an issue. It will become more of an issue with Twitter as being the, or more real-time news flows.
Right.
You're going to need to be able to say, I don't want this one or that one, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
And the whole idea that the news industry should have developed the technologies of news is a major theme. That should be on
your
list.
How do you say that, though?
How do we say that? That's...
Well, I mean, the point was, you know, why... And that was actually in the piece that you included, the one that you included in your class, which is why the hell are the giants of the news industry sitting on the sideline letting a tiny company from San Francisco build the most valuable component of the future system?
The danger of relying on the tech industry for the tools of news.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That
you know what? I figured out why they do this. I think I had the epiphany on why it is that they go to Google and they go to Twitter and they go to, you know, Apple and all these other companies. And it's not a rational thing that they do. It's because their employees are looking for jobs. You know, I saw this happen at my own company. I had a small software company in the 80s in Silicon Valley. And, you know, I was the CEO and founder and chief author of the product. I mean, it was like, this was my labor of life, more than labor of love. It's sort of like I couldn't conceive of myself without this thing succeeding. So I was like on a mission from God, right? I hire these people. I raise money, hire these people. And I figure every one of these guys is now a missionary, like, you know, like I am, right?
Right.
And I find out, of course, that's anything
not true,
not even remotely true. And they start leaving. Okay?
Well,
right, because you know why? Because I give them more visibility than they had before, and my competitors notice them, and they hire them. And I go, man, I can't believe these guys are doing this. You know, all right, I understand this is a high flyer he's going to. This, you know, I watch these guys get, you know, these are people that I thought of as my subordinates, you know, get much richer than I, probably much richer than I ever would be, you know. But that, of course... You know, and so I learned that their motives are not the same as mine. And so, therefore, you have to look at the all companies that way. That's a major lesson. So when you wonder why the New York Times turns to Google for their technology...
It can't hold those people.
Well, those people are inclined to go that way because they're thinking about getting a job at Google.
Yeah.
right? Because they read the same newspaper that they're writing, and they read the dire predictions. They're not idiots. And these are jobs-oriented people,
yeah.
right? I mean, they think, that's how they think. They think in terms of, I need to have a paycheck, I need to have my benefits, I need to have my retirement covered, you know, all this stuff, you know.
Well, there's nothing wrong with worrying about your paycheck.
Oh, believe me. I mean, nothing wrong with worrying about health insurance either.
Yeah, pretty easy to understand.
I'm not saying that they're wrong. I'm just saying that you got to understand that there's this whole sea of motivations that adds up to that these companies don't necessarily do rational things. It's like Microsoft. This whole thing came up with Steve Ballmer said last week that the next version of Windows is the riskiest bet the company has ever made.
And, right. I saw that.
Yeah. I go, wow.
Is that true?
Well, no. I said, you know, this is because this is a company that has been singular in its willingness to risk a lot, okay? So to say that it's the riskiest bet is a pretty strong statement, right? The other thing is that Ballmer is really willing to do that. He's willing to bet on his judgment that way because I don't think his judgment's that good, you know? And yeah, maybe he is doing that, you know? But I'll tell you what, the reason that he's doing that probably has very little to do with the strategy that makes sense for the company to do. Probably more has to do with keeping all those operating system programmers employed,
right?
And keep them with the benefits, because the company probably never seriously considered the possibility of not doing another version of Windows.
Yeah,
right. Even though that should have been on the list, because they just barely squeaked by with this with Vista. It was a tragic situation, almost cost them their franchise and operating systems.
Yeah,
and you know, if you look at the history of this stuff, these companies all go through this. They all go through this point where they produce a really crappy version of their operating system and almost lose it. In some cases, they do lose it. Like Apple had Copeland. Copeland was that operating system. And that was the last, that was the end of development on that operating system. The next thing they did was they acquired Next and bought their operating system from them, you know. So you would think that, you know, being a student of history, even recent history, you would have to consider the possibility that, man, maybe we shouldn't do a new version. Maybe we should just, like, pretend we're doing a new version and just put a few new features in or something. You know?
Well, it's...
But it doesn't work because employees will never go for it.
Right. So when you have these big companies, and this is a factor with NPR, which I want to talk about in a second, but what happens is that additional factors enter into strategic decisions.
Yeah.
And one of them is the cost that the company pays for disturbing its own illusions.
Right.
And what will happen is that the company will steer away from things that are too costly for its own mythology.
And you see that industry, whole industry is doing that.
Whole industries do it, right.
This particular industry that we talk about in this podcast is doing it, okay? And the assumption, I don't think we talked about this last time because it hadn't come quite that clear to me at the time we did the podcast. Or maybe we did. I don't know. But they won't talk about what they do being done for free. They won't think about it.
We did discuss that.
We did. Okay. Yeah. All right. Never mind.
But it's
that's right. We did it on Wednesday.
It's an example of how some areas that the company should investigate and try to look clearly at,
they
steer away from, not because they are unviable, but because the cost internally is simply too high.
Right.
And NPR is caught in that situation
week. How so?
Well,
the Juan Williams thing?
Yeah. Oh. I mean, NPR is in this situation where, several things are going on at once. One is, it's caught in this culture war that engulfs the entire news business, and it keeps getting slammed for liberal bias, just like any other mainstream news provider does. And it becomes a kind of a target. But it's also in trouble because it's got this highly restricted, very sort of traditional code of ethics for its people that don't allow NPR people to tell us what they think. Not only where they're coming from, but just what they think. And it would make a lot of sense, and it would actually solve a lot of problems for them to begin transitioning to a new system. And this is another theme of Rebooting the News, where it's transparency rather than objectivity or neutrality that provides the basis for trusting NPR. But the cost internally of making that shift, of having that debate, of slugging it out with each other over over this direction, and the cost to their own illusions about being nonpartisan, above it all, neutral, is too high. And so it can't actually engage in a transition that it really needs to engage in. And so it's going to be continually caught in this, in these culture wars and flare-ups, like with Juan Williams this week. And just an hour ago, I was on NPR talking about this.
Which show?
On Point with Tom Ashbrook,
yeah,
which comes out of WBUR in
Boston.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was good. It was fun show.
How do you
good.
Talk to that guy? How do you... Tom Ashbrook has one of the most artificial ways of talking of any human being. Oh, all right, never mind.
I didn't find it hard. It was,
really?
No.
Okay.
No.
All
right. I thought it was a good show.
Well, I think King Kaufman had the quote on this one. I loved the way he put this.
How did he put it?
He said, "Objectivity and impartiality are journalism's version of don't ask, don't tell."
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That was such a beautifully
precise
way
yeah.
of saying it, you know?
Yes.
It's like, because the whole topic of don't ask, don't tell is, you know, front and center right
yes.
now, you know?
Correct.
And it's so, you know, and they're also having a... WNYC has their pledge drive right now, and
yeah,
and I'm listening to that every time and I gave them $100. But every time they go through this whole thing, they dance all around the subject of the role of the public in their show, in their whole programming, you know. And
the role of the public is to give money and listen.
Yes, except they can't, right. And you listen to actually how they dance around that, and they can't quite come out and say that.
Right.
They have to say, your contribution is financial.
Well, this is another example of what I'm saying. Another
right.
problem for public radio people is they think of themselves as the most public of all journalists, as the most connected to their communities,
right?
Because
they
are public
it.
Radio,
right?
Right.
Exactly.
We're not commercial. We're not just in this for money, right?
Yeah.
And that is a big part of their self-image. However, if in fact they don't include the public as participants very often in what they do, they won't necessarily know that because this self-image is in their way. So that's another example of the price of the corporate illusion
yeah.
getting in the way of clear-eyed sensibility.
They had, absolutely correct. If they had really had the connection with the public, this Juan Williams thing would have seriously gotten reversed. It would have changed. Now, they did apologize for the way they did it.
They apologized to the staff. Now,
right.
They didn't apologize to the public. The CEO apologized to other NPR people.
I got that. But there was an apology in there, which is a little bit of progress, but
yeah.
I suggest in the piece that I wrote about it that, you know, perhaps they should just retract the whole thing and say, look, actually, we learned something from this situation, and, you know, Juan Williams is paid to have an opinion. That's why he's on NPR. He's an analyst. I mean, it's not like he was, you know, in any way.
But they have a policy that prevents them from saying he's paid to have an opinion. That's what I mean. They have an explicit policy that says NPR analysts cannot give their own views.
What?
That's what my post is about. You got to read Press Think, man. It's a good blog.
Now, hold on a second.
Yes, read my post.
I don't understand that.
Exactly.
Because Juan Williams, it was like Daniel Shore. Was Daniel Shore paid to have an opinion?
He was also an NPR analyst.
I know that.
And okay,
but
so
wasn't he paid to
no,
have an opinion?
No, no.
There was some element. Okay, so there. Let me just see if I understand this. Okay, so
this is what my post is about.
I'm
exactly.
Sorry. Okay, I know I'm making you repeat this, and I'm sorry for that. But is their position basically that there is one accurate and correct opinion about a set of events that Juan Williams and Daniel Shore are responsible for?
Well, sort of. I mean, they don't say it that way. Their position is that There are reporters, and their job is to report, and they never give us their views. There are show hosts, and their job is to host the conversation, and of course they have to remain neutral. There are guests, and they can come on and give their views because they're guests. And then there is this thing called an NPR analyst. And an NPR analyst is supposed to analyze the news, but not give their own view, not enter into public controversies, not give their opinion. And so there's this very narrow, you know, almost arcane space there between quote-unquote straight reporting and analysis, where they're supposed to, like, stay. And it's an impossible role, but if you are a Church of the Savvy person, that's how you can do it, you see? Because you can give, like, the savvy take on events without saying, this is my opinion, this is what I believe, and that's sort of what they want. But what I was trying to say to them in my post, but also on the air today, is that you have to try and imagine how not telling us where you're coming from also generates mistrust. You see, in their minds, if the NPR person does not disclose their view, that can only be good. That can only lead to trust. And what they have to try to grasp is not disclosing your view actually can have the opposite effect. And if it does have the opposite effect for more and more people, that's not up to NPR. That's something that the audience essentially has sovereignty over, right? And if the audience is now seeing opacity as a reason to mistrust a journalist, then NPR has to adjust. But the price of doing that is going to be very high.
It never occurred to me that it was that screwed up.
Do you want to hear something even more amazing? This just happened today. WBUR in Boston, which is the most powerful NPR station in Boston.
I know a lot about WBUR.
Okay,
yeah.
So listen to this. They are now telling donors that you can donate money to WBUR and specify that none of it goes to NPR because of this recent controversy. Can you believe that?
What's the point?
The point is to to recognize this recent Juan Williams furor and allow people who are upset with NPR to give money to their local station.
Right, I understand. So, Jay, is that there are people who are upset with NPR?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Oh, lots.
How do you know that?
Well, we know it in the sense that no issue has ever flooded the ombudsman like this one has.
How are they reaching the ombudsman?
Through, like, the contact us form and through email feedback, you know, the feedback measures that exist.
So we only know from it's from them that we know that this is a
self-report. Yeah, yeah.
There hasn't been a show on NPR about this.
Which?
About this topic.
Yeah, well, today's, and
you were. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so On Point covered this.
Correct, but
who was
not
the
only one?
Who was the other guest on that show?
Alyssa Shepard, the ombudsman of NPR, as well as Mona Charon, who's a syndicated columnist coming from the right wing.
So what do you think? I can't stand listening to On Point. It's like it grates me. You know how some things are like that. You had something like that. I forget what it was. But
sure.
Yeah. What was it?
Washington Week in Review.
Yeah, there
you go. Is an example
right, okay.
of something like.
Well, On Point is like that. I will turn it off as soon as Tom Ashbrook gets on there. I will turn it off. You know. Well, anyway, I don't want to go into detail about that, but so I can't listen to that. But. I don't know. This is just amazing to me that they could. This is could be the catalyst for a real transformation there.
Well, they are actually saying that they're going to look at their policies and they're going to conduct an internal review.
But the question, you see, the internal review is the wrong way to go here. It's totally the wrong way.
It should be a public review.
Well, the whole point is that now's the time to actually get on board with this whole idea that they are a public radio station. You know, they had this whole thing at WBUR. Where, you know, I was in Boston for a few years, and they had this whole pitch on their public, on their pledge drive week, is that the amazing thing about this station, about public radio, is that when you give us money, you become part of the public radio station.
Right.
Well.
Actually, when you give your money, that's the end of it.
That's the point.
Yeah.
Right. The point is, give us the money and then shut the shut the X up.
Right.
And so, but I tried to press the point, and I ended up talking with the president of WBUR, and I swear she totally didn't understand what I was saying.
Yeah.
That it was a foreign concept. And it wasn't like I was coming out of left field. I had an incredible credential at that time. You know, it wasn't like I was like some cab driver. Not to say there's anything wrong with cab drivers, right?
Cab drivers in Boston know a lot.
Well, who knows what they know? I don't know what they know, but you know, it's like I'm not going to say there's you know whatever. It didn't matter. Who the hell are you to tell me that? You know, I mean, it just didn't penetrate. It's this whole idea that you know you've made it, you've reached this place in life, and now you don't want to. You don't want to share that with anybody else. That's the barrier. That's the problem. The problem is that the rest of us look at that situation and with a mix of both frustration in that we're not getting the information, we're not getting talked to like adults. Mm. Some of us care about that. I mean, the major premise of the news organizations is no, you don't care about that. You don't want to be talked to like an adult. You want to be given sort of we want to gloss over this stuff and give us the emotional arguments. Like, there was this great, where did I read this? It was Rich's column. Frank Rich's column was great this week in the New York Times. He talked about how Mike McConnell, the Senate minority leader, soon to be maybe majority leader, on this week said that Obama did something with the bank presidents related to the bailout. And it wasn't Obama that did it. It was Bush that did it. Mm-hmm. In other words, it happened before Obama was in mm-hmm. office.
Yeah.
Everybody that heard this knew it. You know, certainly Christine Amanpour knew it. The person who was talking into her earpiece
knew it. I forced Marketplace to make a correction about that very thing.
Right. Well, yeah. Okay. Why didn't Christine Amanpour say, no, wait a minute, McConnell, that isn't true?
She should know.
She should know. Assuming she did know. And we're assuming that if she didn't know, the person who's talking into her earpiece knew.
They should have corrected it, yes.
Right. But yet they still, now that whole business with Julian Assange, and I noticed you pointed to, because that's how I found out about this whole thing about him walking off, right?
Yeah.
And I watched the video clip.
I watched it too.
And I go, man, that's exactly right. That's what you should do. When you're telling the reporter, I don't want to talk about that, you're free to report about that any way you want to, but I'm not going to comment.
Yeah.
And you do it five times and they still ignore you, then you get up and walk. Did you see the piece the New York Times ran on that?
I saw the piece that they ran about Assange.
Yes, about how he's running away from his. They've got him on the run. That's what the headline said.
You're talking about the profile on Sunday of him.
Yeah,
I read it. I definitely read it.
Trashy piece of journalism, you know. And does the New York Times have a conflict of interest here? Yes, they're getting aced by this guy Julian Assange.
Well, they're also collaborating with him.
Well, that too. But you know what? I suspect that what the pieces like that come more from the fact that he's kicking their ass.
I had a different reaction to it.
What was your reaction?
My reaction was that this may be a situation where the organization needs to move beyond Julian Assange, but it also cannot move beyond Julian Assange.
They asked him that in the interview. And he said basically every organization has a leader and is a lightning rod, and that's what's happening right here and right now.
Yeah, he said something that I'm a supporter of WikiLeaks.
I don't think. Let's get to the core of this. I don't think there's any truth to the allegations.
Which allegations?
That he raped somebody.
I don't want to even talk about. I have no idea. I'm not. Yeah.
But isn't that? It's so dirty, Jay. That's what she was asking him about.
I know. Well, that was ridiculous what she did.
And
there.
Therefore, the Times was making an issue of it.
Well, the Times article was more about internal tensions within WikiLeaks over other matters. And one thing in Assange's interview that disturbed me was he made kind of a big deal out of absorbing criticism and how criticism comes at him and how much criticism he gets. And while I understand what he was talking about, because I've followed the press coverage very closely, the fact that he was so almost like into it made alarm me a little bit. I'm not sure about him. I think he's a very ambiguous figure.
And you know who else is a very ambiguous figure? Bill Keller. Can you imagine Bill Keller ever sitting for a question like that?
No.
Well,
no.
Can you imagine a New York Times reporter?
No, I think
wait a second. Wait.
CNN
no, no,
reporter
this is really
was wrong.
Right.
I said
okay.
that already.
I hear you on
yeah.
that, but I'm going to ask you, I want to be more pointed about this.
Yeah.
Can you imagine a New York Times reporter ever asking Bill Keller a question like that?
No.
Can you imagine a CNN reporter ever asking Bill Keller a question like that? It won't never happen.
Probably not. But
right, because your Church of the Savvy stuff kicks in, and the insider, you know, we're, what was one of your guys said this, that what happens is they end up identifying with the people they cover.
Yeah.
Right? This is a big thing that happens in journalism. Right? It happens. I've seen it happen.
Well, they don't identify with Assange.
That's correct. But you see, the problem is, right, there's the problem.
Yeah.
Is the problem is these are the people who say they're the champions of objectivity, Jay.
Toughness. She was showing her toughness.
Oh, my God. Don't you see, though, that the objectivity is so, they would never do it to Keller, but they would do it to him.
Okay.
Where's the objectivity?
Well, that's a valid point.
Out the window.
Can I tell you an amusing story to wind this up? We have 5 minutes left.
Oh, my God. Really? How
yeah.
did we do that?
This is a great Sources Go Direct story.
Great.
I'm flying on Virgin Air, which I decided to take back from Las Vegas because they have Wi-Fi, mm-hmm. and they also have power at every seat.
I heard that they didn't actually have power at the
yeah,
seat.
Yeah, so they didn't actually have power when I plugged in my laptop. There was no power. So I asked the flight attendants, you know, what's going on? Maybe they can move me to a seat where it wasn't malfunctioning. And they explained to me that actually what happens is that whole sections of the plane go off at different times because there's too much demand for power and it switches off. And so that got me kind of interested. And actually the power never came back on at my seat. And yet the Virgin Air had boasted, we have power at every seat, and obviously this is a major selling point. They are marketing themselves to the internet generation.
Yep.
That's part of their appeal. So when I got back, I said, I'm going to write Fallows about this, because Jim Fallows, at his blog at The Atlantic, often writes about both laptop issues and about air travel, because he's an amateur pilot, and he's very interested in the airlines. So, and I had the ability, because I still had a little power left, to tweet about this while I was on the plane.
Right.
And I knew Virgin America was probably watching their Twitter feed.
Yeah.
And they were. And they got back to me while I was in the air. And they asked me to go to direct message, private messaging, and talk about it. And the corporate spokesman gave me a bunch of mumbo jumbo. And later on explained that the engineers looked at it, and there is an engineering issue, and it's a safety matter. And all the, okay. So I send the whole thing, the whole file to Fallows, with all the communication from Virgin America. And I tell him, you know, I think this is an interesting issue. You should blog about it. So I was pretty sure that he would be interested in it, and he was, and he posted it. And he posted the messages from Virgin America and my complaints and said, you know, does anyone know anything about this? And he has a lot of people who really understand the aircraft business who read him. So he did a follow-up post with information from his readers about why exactly it's hard to supply power to every seat, showing that in fact this is a false claim. They can't actually do it, and they cannot do it. They cannot guarantee power to every seat without going through some very expensive modifications to the airplane, which they're probably unwilling to do because it adds weight, and you know, weight adds expense,
right?
Because
yeah, fuel, right?
And that they're actually not going to do that, and they're also not going to tell you they're not going to do that.
60 seconds,
and so you're going to have to continually suffer through this situation where you think you have power, but you probably don't because they can't actually generate enough.
I get it.
It's just cool because the whole thing was done, the story was explained, the analysis was given without any professional journalists involved except through Fallows posting it on his blog.
Right.
And it's an example of how you can get to the bottom of things just by blogging.
Yeah.
Which is fun.
Absolutely.
That's all I meant. It's a fun little story.
Yeah.
Blogging is fun.
Absolutely. I'm the evangelist for this kind of stuff. I'm always telling people.
That's why I told you the story.
I know. And it's amazing how it's great to tell that story, that kind of story, because people need to do that more often.
Yeah.
You know?
Just ask somebody who knows or who might have readers who know.
Right.
Right?
You have to figure out who has the flow.
And he had the flow.
Yeah. And are we out of time? Is that what happened? Oh, my God. Well, Jay,
See you in the nation's capital.
Oh, my God. Are they ready for us? I don't know.
Watch out, Washington, D.C. All right. Reboot the Capitol.
All right, man.
See you next week.